Hello. Welcome to recording number 12 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. I'm going to begin here on page 84. It's the final paragraph. Gord had changed but little since the day he'd quitted the pursuit of knowledge and resumed his profession. By then, at the age of 16, he had grown to some 5 1/2 feet in height, and his skinny frame had filled out with lean muscle. His beard had been heavy and dark then, too, and his voice surprisingly deep for one with such slight build. His skill at disguise and acting enabled him to appear younger or older as he desired. Now Gord could be a lad of 15 or 16, or a young man in his early 20s, according to need. Right. Well, right here, in the last reading, we had discussed in the commentary about Gord's age, and here we have, pretty much, worked out that Gord would be closer to 19 or 20 years old, and I think that that goes with the years that I've mentioned that have passed. We have here that Gord again is able to disguise and act and so appear younger or older, and that is an ongoing theme. That Gord's part of Gord's skill, and it seems also the skill of thieves within the city of Greyhawk, has a great deal of the acting and disguise about it. And perhaps there's, as mentioned above in the previous recording, that there is a great deal of the swindle and the con in even more than robberies, or the direct approach seems to be much less than a more subtle approach to thievery within the city of Greyhawk. We have given here some statistics for Gord. He's now 5 1/2 feet tall, lean, with lean muscles. I'm a little surprised that they'd have him with a heavy beard, as it's easy to fake, much easier to fake a beard and impossible to fake not having a beard. So I'd be more surprised to see the character with a beard later on, as it'd be harder, would limit the kind of appearances and disguises he could take on. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 85, paragraph 2. Ever since his first introduction to disciplined physical exercise, he had grasped its vital importance to his continued success, and Gord had never abandoned the routine of workouts and rigorous effort. And he had made an effort to keep improving himself in other ways as well, gaining instruction and information from whatever source was available. Gord was a quick study and a good student in all ways. His gray eyes showed that he took things seriously and that he had purpose. He was never satisfied that he had learned enough about some subject, although he understood that he must sometimes abandon one course in order to examine another more fully. Of all his studies in Clerkburg, Gord had most hated to give up the weapon work. Returning for regular sessions to the university district would have been impossible, but of course there were other weapon masters in Greyhawk, so Gord had managed to continue his learning. The problem was that each change of identity required a change of tutor. Appearances might deceive, but never weapon fighting style. Any swordmaster who had engaged in weapon play with Gord would recognize his style blindfolded, in a manner of speaking. That he would soon run out of instructors bothered Gord not a little. Aline had not committed herself to either Sunray or himself, and that bothered Gord far more. His concern came from the friction it caused between them, as much as from his desire for her, and that was the truth. Gord had pondered the situation at length, There were plenty of other beautiful and talented women in Greyhawk. He wanted to lean. If she chose Sunray over him, that would be an acceptable turn of fate, and he could look elsewhere for companionship. It seemed that Talene enjoyed the rivalry too much to make a choice, however, and the resulting strain upon the two young men was eroding the mutually beneficial relationship they had all enjoyed in the past. The three of them used to do everything together, but now either Sunray or Gord was alone half the time. Gord planned capers for himself and Talene, and Sunrise likewise developed adventures that left Gord on the outside. Gord had been left alone on this night, actually, and had been none too pleased with the fact. Thus he acted a bit rashly in once again donning his Sir Margus guise and venturing forth to see what delights the night might hold. Break. All right, so here we're given more about Gord's relationship, a little ideas here on Gord's continuing use of his intelligence and skills and his desire to be more than just a thief. He's learning direct weapon skills. He learned a lot of academic skills. It seems that Gord is mainly at this point following the role of weapon training as a fighter would train, and also his training, or at least self-training, and gathering experience as a thief, and in the manner of thieves, doing a lot with disguise and impersonation. Gord is practicing, he is still taking risks, as he says here, donning his Sir Margus guise again, that he perhaps should have left that alone, but Gord enjoys the sense, the thrill, and the sense of risk. We're given a little idea of Talene and Sunray's character and the rivalry between the three of them. Nothing quite so much that describes the setting here, but more development of Gord and the characters surrounding him. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 86, paragraph 2. No link boy was needed to light the streets in High Quarter. Cressets and lamps hung from its buildings made the streets bright enough. No escort was necessary either, for the broad thoroughfares were well patrolled by the watch, and observed by many private guards in addition. Gord had no need for either torchbearer or protector, having grown up in the darkness and danger of the old city's worst sections, but as a Velunese knight of few years and unknown capabilities, visiting the metropolis of Greyhawk, he would have been obliged to have them for show, had the quarter been any other than it was. He determined to stay within the warmly illuminated avenues of the place, and to stray neither into its more dimly lit, seductive byways, nor beyond its boundaries. With him, as always, was the small sword of finest craftsmanship, which he had disguised with gold wire and gewgaws to appear the trappings of a dandy rather than a weapon, and his familiar old dagger and knife. The former, also embellished, hung at his right hip. The latter was nestled out of sight in his boot. His purse contained a total of 5 orbs value in various types of coin, enough for fun and sportive gaming. The remainder of his winnings, and the rest of other successes too, was cleverly hidden as usual. Not even Sunray or Talene knew where he secreted his wealth. Damn them both. He would have his amusement without any further thought of either. Break. All right, well, here we've got a little description now going of the High Quarter. Well-lit, well-patrolled, private guards employed by the various nobles and wealthy in the city. The city of Greyhawk, which is mapped in the City of Hawks book, it really shows that the elite live in the northwest between the High Quarter and the Garden Quarter. There's trade areas throughout. The old city is up on a kind of plateau, and that contains the worst sections. And you could see that the old wall that surrounds the old city, now it's almost as much a protection against the poor coming from within the old city into the better quadrants as it had been in the past, the protection of the city from the outside world. So we have more descriptions of Gore. Now, his, you know, hiding, disguise, again, disguise and disguising his weapons to show that he appears to be a dandy rather than what he is, an experienced thief and a trained swordsman. We also have that his purse, for fun and sportive gaming, has 5 gold orbs. And that is, for an average citizen, a huge amount of coin. Years worth that would, you know, keep an average citizen alive for years. And at this point in Gord's life, he is now spending as well as stealing among the upper class. And that 5 orbs, that is the coin he's taken out for a night's fun. So the difference between the common and the poor, and then the elite of Greyhawk society, is huge. It's vastly different. There is, you know, that the academic is not as far removed from the poor as the rich is removed from, their society is removed from everybody else within the city. Finally, we're shown here that Gord is still wise enough, at least he's always watching his coin, that he's protecting his savings from his partners, Sunray and Talene. And even though at this point they were good companions, still Gord does not trust his own accumulated wealth to them knowing where it might be hidden. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 86, the last paragraph. Avoiding the Patricians Club, the establishment in which he'd outfoxed Lord Dolph, he walked away from the Citadel towards the less prosperous section where High and Garden Quarters met. There was more excitement to be had there, and less risk posing as a Velonese. It was unlikely that he'd run into anyone thereabouts who knew Sir Margus. He strolled toward the door of the Nymph and Satyr, selected it as a good place to begin, and in a minute was seated and quaffing his first tankard, casually observing the clientele. "Sir Margus, how pleasant to find you here," the voice from just behind his shoulder startled Gord, for he usually detected any nearby presence. 6 cents almost. He turned hurriedly to cover his confusion. It was Arenthal, and the guildmaster was smiling slightly. "I was just speaking of your marvelous success the other evening," he said. "Allow me to introduce my associate to you," for he was fascinated by the tale. Arenthal turned and beckoned. From the shadow of a nearby pillar stepped someone Gord knew well. "Master San of Warwell, may I present Sir Margus of the noble Velenu's house of Luz. Sir Margus, Master San." Gord kept his eyes fixed on his old friend's face, but San never allowed a hint of recognition. Manly San responded, "An honor indeed, sir," and gave a slight bow. Arenthal was not finished. "Come and join us at our table, please. We too are poor company. We offer fine drink and a willing ear for your stories of far Valuna and your travels." The guildmaster was all warmth and smiles as he touched Gord's arm and gestured in the direction of his table across the room. It will be my distinct pleasurable, honorable guildmaster and master, San. Yes, yes, by all means, said Gord, with equal friendliness, moving with them. Let us share a cup or two, and I shall gladly tell you all about my wonderful homeland, and the exciting adventures I have experienced since leaving that far place. Gord gave both fellows an ingenuous smile. Serving maid, he cried out as they reached the table, we need your ministrations here. Like, all right. Now, I mean, here it's quite the meeting here of, we haven't heard from San in, I believe, at least 2-3 years now. And here San is in company with the Thieves Guild Guildmaster, Arentol. So we have a kind of a watershed moment here, this meeting again of Gord's old friend San, who should be still a very young man, and the meeting again for the first time. Now, we're also given the name of an inn or tavern here, the Nymph and Satyr, which is located in the area between the High and Garden quarters. So we're told that between the two, the meeting place between those two quarters is less prosperous, perhaps more than less prosperous than both High and Garden. If you remember back when, at the beginning of the story, with Violet, Gord is sent as a serving boy in her company in a thieving operation for the Beggars Union. And that's where things began to really change for Gord. And here, in this section, perhaps this area has always been a little more commonplace than the Patricians Club, which is a gambling hall meant for the highest level of the aristocracy and the elite, the wealthy, among the City of Greyhawk citizens and rulers. Now, again, we have poor Gord running into Arentol, but the Guildmaster of Thieves, even though he is at the top of the hierarchy of leadership of the City of Greyhawk, he still is here frequently by either luck or design, the place where Gord has come to get entertained for the night. We have Gord again in disguise, very quick on his feet. We don't know how, and here he is Sir Margus of the Velonese House of Luz. Now, or Luez, or Lewis, it's the pronunciation could be several things. But here it's quite possible that is, and I'd even say likely that Gord would steal the name of an actual Velonese family, and a noble family, rather than just make something up that could be used against him. We have a very, very slight description of what's going on. Pardon me for one sec. All right, and we have a little introduction here of the Nymph and the Satyr, and it seems to be just a normal tavern or inn rather than a gambling house. All right, I am going to restart here. And we have mentioned, I will say before I restart, that we have the mention also that San is called San of Warwell. And there's no really context given, but obviously San, his past is either being hidden from Arentol, or more likely Arentol is hiding, San is also applying a persona of greater, social standing than he would be as San of the workhouse or the Beggars Union. All right. I'm going to restart here. It is page 87, the last paragraph. If the Lord of Greyhawk's head thief thought to test Gord on his knowledge of Valuna and the lands around, he had not reckoned with that worthy's previous schooling. While Gord had never been more than a mile beyond the walls that encircled the city, he had spent many hours reading history, studying geography, and hearing lectures on such faraway places. Perhaps Arentol thought Sand's smiles were due to the elaborate lengths Gord went to in the near monologue that ensued, or perhaps he attributed the cheerfulness to the young man's ability to storytell. Gord knew that his old chum was secretly laughing deep inside as Gord related, nearly word for word, what both had heard from a particularly dry and windy professor. Gord intermixed a bit of his own fanciful creations with all, but the context was unmistakable. Finally, after nearly 2 hours and many draughts of the most expensive liqueur the establishment offered, Arentol broke in. That ring on your finger, as I recall you said, it was a valuable family heirloom when you wagered it at the game. Ring, Gord allowed his gaze to move idly to the piece of jewelry on his finger. As his mind raced, he had underestimated the guildmaster. Mistake. "You mean this," he said, holding up the chrysoberyl barrel and moving it slightly so that the large green's cat's eye winked back and forth in the light. "Great Foltus, no. This tramplum is no family treasure. I mean..." Gord used his utmost duplicity to make the whole sound like indifferent and demeaning speech. "Odd," commented the guildmaster. "I'd have sworn that you said it was a treasure." "No matter. If it is no family heirloom, where from came it?" "Aha, you're on to it, clever fellow. It's worth a bit of coin, and it does mean much to me. You guessed at the tale, so now I shall relate it for you." At first, the guildmaster seemed interested, but after minutes of preamble, he began to shift restlessly in his seat. He politely suggested that Gord get to the point. Gord assured him he was doing that, and then the young man went on to tell of a meeting with a devious gypsy and his band of sullen cutthroats, how they had tried to first dupe, then overwhelm him, and how he had finally slain the leader in single combat, thus gaining the ring. At this, Arentol grumbled softly and abruptly excused himself to go to the Jakes. After letting a couple of minutes pass in silence, Sand spoke. "You've put him off, Gord," he murmured with his flagon held before his mouth. "He's suspicious of you now, and I'll never stop until he finds out for sure. One way or another, whether you are who you claim to be." Sand cast a glance over his shoulder, checking to see if Arentol was on his way back to the table, while he waited for a response. Clearly nervous for himself as well as for his friend of old, he faced Gord again and with sad eyes gave him a last whispered piece of advice. "You'd best get out of Greyhawk while you can." Gord smiled, but drained his cup instead of replying. Guildmaster returned, and within moments thereafter, Sir Margus graciously took his leave. Lean found the note first and read it aloud to Sunray. "My dear friends, I am so sorry I must leave without proper farewell. A messenger from my family has brought me news that I am urgently required in Valuna. Do visit if you ever should come there. Your most loving servant, Margus." "What is this shit?" demanded Sunray. Aline looked up from the note, her face contorted in anger. "Bastard has skipped with everything," she shrieked. But that was a lie. Gord had left a pair of luckies next to the note. End of chapter 9. Well, we're given a lot more about Gord, and still that... still that San is friendly with him and giving him what Gord obviously sees as good advice and an indication of how San knows a bit more about how Arenthal truly is. What is interesting as far as the setting information to me is the description of the knowledge that Gord, in his 2 years of study, well, one year with Prosper and 2 years at Grey College, of the information that Gord has found useful, and that he's learned, geography and history, and Valuna is a faraway place to him, which is, pretty far across to the west of the Flaness from the city of Greyhawk, but still much. There are many, many other places that Gord may have not even have heard about in his studies. But here we have the preparation that this Grey College can teach and give for a character background all these various bits of information about what, without having led history, geography, lectures of faraway places. Now, within the story, we again have the ring being brought up, and we have a mention of Foltis here, used as a, used as a kind of, like Great Caesar's ghost here. It is Great Foltis, no. So again, I think before we've had this too, is that the deities are used are sworn by and commonly used and known to the citizens in Greyhawk and of various pantheons, all kind of intermixed, modern and Flan and Sul and Iridian and even Baclunish, where Istis is mentioned. So we have a more of a at least a cosmopolitan feel to the city of Greyhawk. Finally, we have Gord, even if he was able to keep the hiding place of his own coin, obviously his companions Talene and Sunray were not quite as smart or more trusting than Gord had been. And when Gord leaves, he leaves with all, except for a pair of luckies, Electrum luckies, that Talene and Sunray may have kept as their own little nest egg. All right, I am going to restart, and it is page 90, chapter 10, first paragraph. Furl that sodomized sail, you mud-sucking shitfoot. Captain was not one to mince words, especially in the middle of a vicious storm. "Aye, aye, Captain," Gord replied, tearing at the flapping canvas. He was near to being blown off the barge by the combined force of wind and sail, nearly blinded by the sheets of driven rain, exhausted, but he obeyed as well as he could. "Well, moved your blasted buns, then. How in hell can I save us all from visiting the bottom with the likes of you crewing this tub?" Gord had the sail in hand now, and several others of the Rene crew were helping him to secure it with stout lines so that it wouldn't break loose again. "Avast there, you blasters!" Gord heard the captain shouting in a bellow that managed to defeat the howl of the storm. "We need that gaff sail to keep her headed." Then a shrieking blast of wind tore away the rest of the sentence. Finished with securing of the lug sail, he and the others hurried to the hatchway and ducked below deck. Gord didn't envy the man on the tiller, the watch, or the captain during times like these. Conditions in the cramped, pitching, below deck area weren't wonderful, but at least it was warm and dry. After he left his farewell note at the Villa Noblesse, Gord had headed for the river quarter. Without conscious effort, he took precautions so that his journey would go unnoticed, and he would not be trailed by some agent of Arenthal. After entering the district of sailors, longshoremen, and teamsters, he made doubly certain by taking specific measures designed to lose any follower. Then he backtracked a bit just for extra insurance. He had left all of his fancy garments behind, and his current peril was unremarkable. No sense in taking chances, he thought, and went one step further. A bit later, Gord strode through the wharf gate, clad as a riverman, sea bag on his shoulder, soft cap pulled low on his forehead to help hide his features, ring nowhere to be seen. It had been easy to locate a Rene Lord, willing to take on a working passenger. Gord simply approached a likely candidate, standing on the dock beside his barge, and made his request while gesturing in a signal from the secret language of the Rene folk. The barge master was surprised, but had not asked any questions, and overcharged Gord by only a few coppers. He introduced himself as Miklos. All right, now here at the beginning of chapter 10, we have Gygax using the language of kind of classical, perhaps even, from movies or TV, the kind of seaman's language that you'd get from the captain. Again, it feels a little out of place to me, less fantasy medieval and more 18th, 19th, early 20th century kind of language. It's not terrible. My own concept of the Rene would be that they would have more of their own language than the captain is showing. And here the captain is a Rene Lord. So I'm not sure if that every captain of an individual barge is considered a lord by the Rene, or whether this captain is higher rank within the, within the society of the Rene. So we have, again, Gord being able to not only have the ability to appear as a sailor and wisely abandoning, since he wants to avoid Arentol and being followed, his role as Sir Margus, he wants to abandon that all, leaves behind his companions, leaves behind his probably expensive clothing, and instead, is now in the guise of a normal sailor, making his way, and then also showing that he does know something of sailing, because here he is among the Rene, and even though the captain is cursing at the various sailors, it seems like Gord does know his way around the barge. He had stayed for weeks, months even, when the Beggar Thieves War was going on, among this small community of Rene barge folk that were 11 or 12 barges lashed together on the quays of the city of Greyhawk. So we're introduced here to Miklos, who's the captain. We get a little idea of the teamsters, sailors, longshoremen that inhabit the river quarters. We also have a mention again of the secret language of the Rene. So we're given a couple languages. In the way that we talk about Greyhawk currency, we're also seeing in the setting the various language common, Oridian, Sewell are all mentioned, and then these special signaling languages, or the thieves' cant, the merchants' cant, the silent language of the beggars, and the Rene, which seems to be a gesturing language, but also more than likely, besides a secret language, the Rene have their own cultural language as well. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 91, paragraph 3. Barge had sailed that same day, beating slowly up the Sullaton River, headed for the ports of call of the near Dev and beyond. Going upriver on such a craft was easy, if somewhat tedious. The barge was some 6 paces or so wide, not quite 4 times as long. Although it had a shallow draft less than a fathom unless heavily loaded, so as to enable it to navigate shallow waters and be easily beached, it was equipped with a pair of side keels that were lowered to stabilize the craft when it sailed in deeper waters. The freeboard was quite high, and the rails planked stoutly for protection. The roundish bottom was planked over, as was the beck, to provide a secure space for cargo and crew, the latter being the family of the captain, the master being lord of the barge, dwelt in an above-deck cabin abaft. Smaller versions of this sort of barge had but a single mast. This Gord had observed during his stay with the Rene years ago. Being one of the larger sort, however, the barge of Miklos had a small mizzenmast, as well as the stout foremast. There were nearly 2 dozen souls aboard, only about half of whom were adults. All but babes in arms had duties to perform, as Gord learned immediately. Everyone, it seemed, was expected to take a turn at the sweeps when the air was calm or the wind foul. Like, all right, now here's a little answer to that, is that the Renee Lord is the Lord of the barge, and that the crew is made up of the Renee family. So a very insular group here, and a very interesting cultural group to add to your Greyhawk campaign. I know that a lot of campaigns, they tend to overlook the Rene and the Atloy, who are the cousins of the Rene, who they have the classical gypsy caravans, whereas the Rene, also called as gypsies, they are barge folk, and they ply their trade up and down the rivers. So we have the first mention, I believe, of the Sullaton and the near Div, and how that the barges are shallow, so as to be able to ply their trade up and down the up and down these rivers. And in later setting material, you learn that they ply up and down the near Div, the Virvadev, and up and down that river past Verbonic, all the way up to Ket, and all the way over to Greyhawk. So within this area of the Flaness, you're going to find the Rene should be easy to encounter. All right, I'm going to restart right here. There's some information here about the physical description of the Rene barges. Single-masted for the smaller ones, double for the bigger ones. And even these double ones are fairly crowded, given the size that Gord is describing of the barge itself. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 92, paragraph 2. Eventually, they had left the banks of the Sullaton behind and sailed out onto the deep blue of the lake of unknown depths. When they left the green shores of the river astern, Gord had seen the crew getting out their armament. From below came scorpions, heavy crossbows, and jugs of lamp oil. The scorpions, huge crossbow-like engines designed to propel heavy missiles as large as lances, nearly 2 furlongs, were set into their sockets at bow and stern. The normal crossbows were stowed near swivels mounted on the scantlings or planked side rails. Missiles for both were likewise kept in side lockers against the time of their need. Finally, the oil pots were secured in netting along both starboard and port beams. One of the crewmen had informed Gord that the oil would be used in emergencies only, such as when some sea monster attacked and could not be driven off by any other means. The oil would be dumped upon the attacking creature, and in the surrounding water, and a torch set to all. The fire risk to the barge was obvious to even so green a lakefarer as Gord. All right, so this is Gord's first time out on the rivers and off into the wider waters of the Lake of Unknown Depths and near Div. And here we have a description of the Rene Bard's armaments and what they're being prepared for. Also, that larger monsters, you know, waterborne monsters, sea monsters, are common enough so that here they are well prepared with the larger scale scorpions and the hand crossbows and burning oil already, not talking about repelling, you know, pirates or bandits, but talking about fighting off sea monsters. So, you know, we have a little description that is from mention that Gord hasn't been beyond a mile outside the city walls. Dahiri is now getting experience as a on the rivers and on the lakes, and obviously getting practical experience in being a sailor. And as Gord is a quick study, these things tend to come pretty easily to him. Learning is a very easy experience for Gord. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 92, paragraph 3. At first, the near Div's azure waters had been as calm as a tranquil pool. Gord had not known how fortunate he had been then. Cursing the lack of wind, he had taken his turn rowing, unaware of the possible alternatives. When the wind began gusting next day, he had first thought himself blessed. But by that evening, the heavy pitching and rolling of the barge had made him awfully, terribly sick. The night had been sheer torture, but next morning was worse. The wind howled around him at near gale force. The cold was acute, which caused him to shiver and made him feel even worse. As bad as Gord felt, it occurred to him that the vessel seemed to be even sicker than he was. Its rigging shrieked as sails and lanyards were stressed to their limits. The barge tossed and seemed likely to founder at any moment. Then Gord stopped thinking about his own misery as the storm struck in full force and the wind got even stronger. He had to do so many things that he forgot his seasickness. Now that things were well secured above, he was able to rest for a bit below deck. He dropped into his hammock and fell asleep quickly, despite the motion, smell, and noises from the children and adults also in the place. It seemed that he had just closed his eyes when a hand was shaking him awake again. Time to take his turn bailing. The scow seemed to be full of leaks, but of course it was simply the strain of the rough weather upon her boards. The Rene were clever folk, Gord observed. A system of pulleys and ropes was set up so as to make bailing the barge more efficient. One or two of the crew worked at emptying the bilge with leather buckets. The contents of these they poured into a trough that slanted to where the pulley system was. Another crewman, a child actually, stationed there, opened and closed a gate to fill buckets circling the cogs. Each canvas vessel tipped its contents out into another trough that ran from barge to lake through the cabin window. Collapsed, the bucket returned and was soon beneath the trough, ready for another outpouring. While a lot of water spilled to the planks and returned to the bilge, most of it was emptied thus. Two women operated the lifting rig, and Gord was one of three men now plying buckets to empty the bilge. It was back-breaking work. The spring tempest died suddenly around noon. It had driven the barge well out into the near Div and caused a fair amount of damage to hull and rigging. The small boat that had been towed astern was gone, lost who knew where. Rene set to work immediately repairing the damage, running new cords and lines, and setting up the artillery with new strings and ropes. The captain was everywhere, ordering this, commanding that, and taking a personal hand whenever things didn't look right to him. Craft was under full sail now, running southeast toward the shore some 10 leagues distant, according to Yanow, a fellow of about Gord's own age. How he knew this, Gord had no idea. Why are dry strings being put on the crossbows? Why are the quarrels being set out? Gord asked. Yanow grinned. Monsters like to check the surface after a big storm. Lots of good stuff for them to eat then, he said. Jake. All right, well, we've got a nice little description here of of a storm and its effect on the barge, but it can also be used as for anyone, you know, who wants a little idea on that, a little description to use as what could happen to a merchant ship or even a ship of war out on the seas of Greyhawk or the Near Dev, the large lake. And we have some information about what's going on, that after such a storm, we can expect an attack by some of the larger sea creatures out there.
Do we know what time of year it is?
No, I don't offhand. Okay. It might be mentioned, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I wasn't sure because I missed the beginning, but I wanted to compare it to what it was like in Greyhawk.
Yeah, and now, no, I don't know. There's no mention, although it has mentioned that the winters in Greyhawk seem fairly mild, not snow, but cold and wet. There's no mention of any kind of cold weather gear being worn. Gord is wearing his fancy clothes out. There's no mention of a cloak or overcoat. And when he leaves, there's no real mention. There is, right here, which you probably caught, was that they do run into a severe storm.
Right.
And it would be interesting if there was some information that it happened during a certain season within in the city of Greyhawk and the surrounding areas. So here we have Gord has now left the city of Greyhawk. We've now in this book we're finishing up chapter 9, I believe, or on chapter 10, and here we are on page 93, and where he is now moved beyond the environs of the city. We get a little description of how the Rene run their boat, and it seems like it is a very well thought out and efficient systems. A little bit of technology there with their their bilge buckets being on this kind of conveyor belt kind of thing that they're running by hand, so they can swiftly empty their bilge. The barge is shallow, so it should also be fairly stable, but also easy to swamp with water. We're given a little physical description of upper and lower deck and a captain's cabin abaft, of how the Rennie barge might look. And again, we have an example of Gord always trying to learn. That even here he is he's one who will ask questions and learn from them. We have that he's at first time out, it's on the waters, he gets seasick, but again he's able to overcome that by necessity. So we have a little more about Gord's character and his abilities, and we have a little setting information here about the Rene and the Near Div. And the kind of thing you could expect, the sea monster encounters after a storm. So all good material for building up the campaign. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 93, the last paragraph. Lord suddenly felt sick again. No wonder Lord Miklos was in so much of a hurry to make the coast. Deep waters were certainly no place to be now. He redoubled his efforts at readying the weaponry, simultaneously regretting his decision to travel by water. All to no avail. The worst happened almost immediately. Break. Well, here we have a picture, a Clyde Caldwell picture of a large sea serpent on the top half of page 94. Yep, and we have a little more description of, you know, the captain's reasoning and the dangers out on the lake. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 94, paragraph 2. Ahoy, Captain Miklos, critter off the stern and coming fast. Warning came from the boy posted by the tiller watching for critters. It was some critter, Gord thought, as he got his first look at the looping coils and huge head of the monster chasing the vessel. Critter indeed. The spear-casting machine at the rear of the barge was already being loaded and wound back even as Gord stood and stared at the creature. So this was one of the dreaded sea serpents he had heard about. It was now about 200 yards distant, coming closer with each heaving motion of its snaky body, with toothy maw agape. Gord, its mouth seemed large enough to bite the stern clean off the barge. Miklos shoved the gawking young man aside so that he could get to the scorpion and aim it himself. Gord came out of his shock and followed. Somebody handed him one of the wood-veined missiles for the great crossbow. Gord took it with him to a place near the captain. The monster had closed to about 150 yards now. Miklos peered intently along the shaft of the missile, a lanyard in his left hand, his right moving the scorpion so that the barbed iron spearhead pointed directly at the oncoming creature. Miklos suddenly twitched his left hand. The steel arms of the scorpion sprung forward, and the pointed lance flashed out with a deep twanging sound. To Gord's untrained eye, the missile seemed to appear magically protruding from the monster's neck, a couple of feet below its head. "Not this snaky son of a bitch!" shouted the helmsman. The thing let forth a bellowing hiss that would have deafened anyone close to it. At just over 100 yards distance, it was awesome. The crewman snatched the missile Gord was stupidly holding onto as he gawked, transfixed by the sight of the creature. The crewman hastily loaded the great lance into the scorpion, while cursing Gord for being a fool. And worse, Gord's shame overcoming his terror for a moment could not disagree. Within seconds, the big machine was again loaded and winch taut, and the captain was aiming the second missile. "This time you eat my toothpick, stinking shitmouth," Miklos shouted as he shot the huge bolt at the serpent. The missile struck the head, but the thing was covered with thick scales as large as Gord's hand. These scales turned the point, and the shaft caromed off into the air. A swarm of buzzing quarrels from the heavy crossbows followed the larger bolts, and most of these likewise inflicted no apparent harm upon the creature, though a few struck home. Break. All right, well, we get several things here. Gord, although experienced in some things, this would be his first direct combat with a large monster. And at least that I can tell. And here he freezes up. So even though he's an experienced thief and he's trained himself to be a swordsman, this first of a large combat experience kind of sets him back on his heels. We also learn a little more about the kind of sea monster is. It's got an armored head. We learn its rate of speed. Now here they fired that heavy crossbows, the scorpion, twice, and perhaps they could have even fired it again if Gord hadn't been so frozen up. But here we learn a little bit of the monster's speed chasing after the barge. It goes from 200 yards to 150 to 100, so it's closing rapidly. And we also have an example of how Gygax portrays a combat damage, because it's not necessarily that those bolts all missed enough to not draw down hit points. It's that the structure of hit points in the game, those things could be direct hits, but they are not necessarily, you lose hit points because you're physically injured. You can also lose hit points because of the creature's, a little exhausted. It can be that there is damage being done to the hit point total that isn't reflective of actual one-on-one damage. So in this, Gygax is describing combat in a way that can match the AD&D game, but it also isn't like a direct one-for-one simulation of combat.
I was going to say, this is why Gord left the university, right? He wanted some action.
That's exactly right. Although it seemed more like he wanted a little more, fun and excitement than direct combat with a large creature.
It's interesting that he freezes.
Yes, yes. And, I like that actually in the story, that Gord, does freeze up. And that could simply, because combat is a simulation, it could be that could be a fumble. That could be a miss. It could be, an explanation of a DM of why no hit points are drawn, or the way that dice roll, that characters can fail initiative, that they can fail at striking a creature. And you can even fail to damage when you do strike a creature. It's nice to see the description also of the kind of monster that characters could face. And without it being so high level that it would simply destroy, you notice it's the captain, the most experienced of the Rene here, who's doing the firing. So here, with the big scorpion, he is the one. He's described as, one, doing a physical damage in its throat, and two, hitting it, but only being reflected by the armor. So here we have the captain able to fire that bit of siege, the heavy, heavy crossbow here, the scorpion, and to be able to fire twice and hit twice. So it really speaks that the captain is an experienced hand, if not a direct fighter, then an experienced hand at using this heavy piece of siege equipment, the scorpion.
Yeah, it's nice to see Gord isn't infallible, too, because a lot of things come very easy to him. And once in a while, it's nice to see that he does have some pitfalls and he's like a little bit human. There's not too many times which he's failed at things.
Yeah, and of course, as we go further in the stories, other than City of Hawks, which retraces the steps back to his origin, or Knight Errant, which doesn't really say at what point Gord is at in his experience levels, that we have examples here of Gord at a lower level and not so infallible, which I had found. But I have to say, I still find the language a little...
Yeah, the shit eater part or whatever was like, it just didn't fit.
Yes, and also, if you think, the boy is supposed to be part of the Rene family, that when he's shouting the warning, he's using a kind of, 19th century, early 20th century language, and it would have been more interesting, I think, to have set a way for them to speak in their own idiom than in what seems a little out of place to me. But still, I have to say, in the story, I'm enjoying the action in the story.
Yeah, it's exciting.
It's much better than I had remembered. I haven't read this in a long while, and I think I was a little overly critical the last time. A little too jaded, probably. Yeah. And so far, it's not been a bad story. And it has moved along at a good pace, provided background. And here we have, we're only close to a third through this book. And already Gord has moved from the Greyhawk, the city of Greyhawk, into the wider world.
Yeah, and they're talking about one of the great mysteries of the world, with the near-div.
Yes. And, You know, also, I really found that the Rene were a very underutilized character in the setting material that came later. I know at one point I was working on a fan-created adventure for the Rene, but I can't really think of anything that talks about them or uses them in adventures or perhaps something in Dungeon Magazine, but I feel they're very underutilized in the Greyhawk setting. And yeah, here, used
twice at least, though, right? Here.
Yes, and here I think Gygax, at least as a lower level and maybe even a mid-level campaign, that they are perfectly suited for it and a very exciting, interesting addition to the city. They're, you know, like Greyhawk isn't a pirate city, but here it has this alternate Rene culture that is obviously going to all these various ports and cities in the area, but at the same time separate from them. So, but I mean, there are enough in Greyhawk that they are originally allied with the Beggars Union. And still, even though that is an open alliance, I'd guess, they still weren't punished for it.
It's more like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I think. I don't think that they're natural allies, but...
Yes, but definitely not allied to the Thieves Guild.
Definitely.
And the Thieves Guild's the power, so it's very interesting that we don't hear of any kind of punishment for the Rene for having been allied with the Beggars Union. And that would speak to maybe they are one of the more reliable suppliers of trade, you know, up and down these lakes. Obviously, the barge folk should be, for the various, for the various riverways, they should be a pretty, essential part of trade deeper into the Flaness here, and that a lot of areas would not, if there weren't for the river trade, imagine the things coming down to Greyhawk and down the river and things going up the river, and also because of where they're going, there would be link, I believe the river goes all the way up, the Velverdiva goes up to Bissell, or if not that, maybe even up to Ket. And here, Ket and Bissell, they are the doorway between the Flaness and the Baclunish lands. So I would say that if you want interaction beyond the Flaness and get the trade of the far west, then you'd be seeing most of that coming down that river.
Yeah, I think the Rene would be good as allies and as enemies.
Yes. And strong enough so that they can't be supplanted or punished, even though their involvement with that Beggars Union, it's very interesting that they're just not, they're not attacked, their barges aren't attacked during the war, that they're really left to side with the Beggars Union, but at the same time, not to face, seemingly face punishment to be on the losing side.
Maybe we just didn't hear about it, because I'm pretty sure the Thieves Guild would have known about it.
Yes, I'm sure that the Thieves Guild knew quite a bit about what was going on
before they acted.
Yeah, and even the Thieves Guild there was obviously part of the... that the structure of the directors and the way the government is run, the Lord Mayor, how Theobald, says that the Lord Mayor betrayed me. And so it's very interesting to me. It also shows, a more advanced civilization, an advanced culture, that they wouldn't immediately just apply, a reaction against their foes. I remember back when Rome was undergoing its very first, kind of civil wars going on at the end of the Republican era, the era of the Republic. These two famous generals, Marius and Sulla, they had this thing where when they fought back and forth, and when one would win, like one would seize Rome, he would kill all the supporters of his enemies, so that families would have to have one member of the family siding with Sulla and the other siding with Marius, so that they could maintain control of their properties and their, you know, resources within Rome and, you know, within those sections of Italy, when either Marius, because eventually Sulla was even driven out of all of Italy, and if Marius hadn't been an older man, he only lived a year after his conquest of over Sulla, and then Sulla was a younger man when Marius died, he came over, but some of the people, including like Julius Caesar, had been spared, but it was a very, you know, their civil war was very, a very bloody civil war right there. And so we've got a good picture there of the near Dev, how far away Valuna is, you know, right up against, but it's not so far away. I mean, it's just beyond Verbabank. We have the river stretching all the way up to Lake Quag and all the way
start, yeah, I think,
to the Bramblewood Forest, where it gets into Kett. And, you know, like I said, Bissell and Kett, that pathway between the mountain chains down there is the big opening between the Baclunish West and the Flaness East. And right there with a river that can lead you all the way down to the near Dev and eventually the city of Greyhawk, all the way up to Perrinland. That is quite the, you know, quite a trading route that is right there.
North from Lake Quag, almost to Blackmore.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that would be the next opening for trade into the West is... getting up there into the wolf and tiger nomad lands, and then up into Al and Ekbar. But really, the closest place is down in Kett.
Yeah.
And Kett is Baclunish, and Bissell is a Flanish country. So you have this east and west right there. Well, I'm going to end things for today. We're past seven. I did want to check out the, you know, Lord Gassumba show going on tonight, which begins at 7:30. So, this was recording number 12. I believe, the archives go up to the 18th, and they've been being caught up all this time. So, hopefully we'll get these last couple shows archived, and we are reaching, I think about a quarter through, are a little greater, because we're now about a third through the book, and you know, I'm looking at 40 to 50 of these recordings to cover commentary and the actual reading of the text. So I'm going to say good night. I'm going to punch in the end of the recording, and I plan on being back tomorrow for recording number 13.